Our fourth case for this morning is United States against Medina. And we'll hear from Ms. Gambino.
Good morning, Judge Wood, Judge Hamilton, Judge Darrow. Nasiru Medina was deprived of liberty based in large part on unreliable and uncorroborated statements of an individual who never appeared before the court. And in this particular case, it's very important when you are going to sentence someone to a term of 15 years, in this case 15 years and 10 months, and you're going to increase, the district court is going to increase the sentence based on relevant conduct.
Well, how did the district court increase the sentence when the statutory maximum was well above what the ultimate sentence was?
The district court increased the penalty that he was facing based on unreliable evidence under the guidelines.
But wasn't the penalty he was facing, I think, 10 to life?
It was 10 to life. The mandatory minimum in the case was 10 years, and the provable evidence in the case would have justified a sentence of 10 years. And in order to increase the sentence above the 10 years, the district court had to look at some evidence, and this court and the Supreme Court have said it has to be reliable evidence, in order to increase the penalty further under the guidelines. So when the government asks for an increase in the sentence under the guidelines, it has to provide some support for doing so. And in this case, the support that was provided were the out-of-court and untested and uncorroborated statements of a co-defendant in the case.
So, Ms. Gambino, I can understand your choosing to make this argument for purposes of preserving it for the Supreme Court, which has not yet taken the step for inside guidelines changes that you're arguing for. But as Judge Sherrill points out, I mean, his sentence is squarely inside the statutory range, and this is certainly not the first case where we've seen amount estimates by the kind of person you're describing. And in fact, the district judge gives you quite a bit of the benefit of the doubt by rejecting the government's 50 to 150 range and pulling it down to the 15 to 50, where we know about 10 kilos. She just has to find 5 more kilos. And it seems to me there are many ways she could do that. So short of a Booker-like revolution in the way sentencing happens, which you never know. I mean, we didn't expect Booker either, so I don't have any problem personally with your preserving an argument, but I don't see how the law as it now stands can support your position.
Well, the law as it now stands, and certainly there are two components to my argument, as you point out. One is the standard, and that is in transition. But even if we look at the law as it now stands, this court sees case after case after case in which relevant conduct is at issue. And it's true that the court below is looked at to see if the sentence is reasonable. In this particular case, the sole basis for increasing the sentence as requested by the government and as done conservatively by the court was completely unreliable and untested. And that has to have some meaning. A person who loses 5 years of liberty is entitled to have due process in the deprivation of that liberty.
Well, you say that the statement was untested and unreliable. What do you make of the fact that, I guess it could be corroborated by the fact that the defendant actually had a large amount of cocaine consistent with the estimates in his own possession, as well as the statement, I think the district court relied heavily on the fact that the statement was against self-interest.
Well, the problem with the statement is that there wasn't just one statement, as the district court pointed out. In fact, there were three different statements that were made by this individual. And this individual, each time he was asked about what his dealings were with Mr. Medina, he provided a different estimate. And the court had no opportunity to test this person to see whether this person was reliable at all, and had evidence before it that every time you asked this person what he did, he was going to provide a different answer. And, of course, this was just when he was asked by the government on three separate occasions. He never was brought before a court. His testimony was never subject to cross-examination or challenge of any kind. So we have evidence that he is, in the first place, unreliable. To respond to the second part of your question, the surveillance that was done during the course of this investigation started from 2007 and lasted until 2009. There were only two occasions upon which Mr. Medina was surveilled, and he wasn't a part of the wiretap investigation with the exception of one or two phone calls that occurred over the course of a very long period of time. And there was surveillance of Mr. Melendez, the person on whose statement the court relied, dealing with a variety of other individuals, including those that the government identified as associated with the Arellano Felix cartel. So their surveillance didn't support a finding that Mr. Medina was a regular supplier. The government conceded that they had no evidence whatsoever to corroborate Melendez's claims that his dealings went back to 2000. And lasted from 2000 all the way through 2008.
But even if it was just a year, I mean, we can agree that the district court didn't adopt the very ambitious estimates that Mr. Melendez would have supported. But there are phone calls where Melendez is referring to Medina as a supplier. There are lots of contacts between them. Medina has all kinds of money that's impossible to account for. Through his taxable earnings, for example. I mean, it only would have taken a year or so worth of dealing to come up with those other 5 kilos, maybe not even a year.
But the point is there was absolutely no evidence of that. And, in fact, the transactions that occurred, there were controlled buys, at least two controlled buys between Mr. Melendez and a cooperating informant, and those were for one-ounce amounts. And when Mr. Melendez's store was searched, there were 208 grams of cocaine found. And on another occasion, he was responsible for another 249 grams. So we're not talking about the kinds of quantity or the regularity that would support a finding that so much more cocaine was involved in this particular case. And
go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And the phone conversations themselves also do not support a finding that Mr. Medina was the supplier. And it's interesting to note that Mr. Melendez himself was sentenced based on the 15 to 50, although he was admittedly involved with many other suppliers in addition to whatever he claimed he did with Mr. Medina. So there isn't any support in the actual evidence for that, and there's no way of relying on what he said in order to use that as a basis for increasing the penalty above what the actual evidence supported.
Medina admitted that he had been dealing from 2007 to 2009, didn't he? As part of the guilty plea?
Yes, he did.
Okay. And at the time of the arrest, I'm just trying to do the math, but we've got 1 kilo in his deal, his agreement with Melendez, right?
It was an agreement. It was not, the 1 kilo was not ever actually delivered.
The agreement's enough to count against
right.
him, right?
That's correct.
Medina's got 9 kilos in his garage.
He does.
And he's got $124,000 in cash in his garage.
He does.
Which is not quite wholesale value of 5 kilos, right?
It could be, depending on the price, but Mr. Medina had also offered an explanation for that, which hasn't been...
He's offered an explanation, right, but you've got him with just about 15 kilos at the moment that things are shut down, and he's admitted to being involved in distribution for at least well over a year. So this looks like, I got to say, it looks like a pretty reasonable estimate to me to put him in the 15 to 50 range.
I can understand why you would say that, but the point is, the estimate has to be based on reliable evidence, and
well,
to the extent
the
that she...
1 and 9 and 124,000 get you in the neighborhood of 15 without even taking into just at that moment, right? So what's unreasonable about assuming that there was a little more over the last year or more?
Because that's not what she actually relied on. What she relied on was the statement of Mr. Melendez.
Well, she's relying, the way I read it, in essence on the the volume of stuff he had at the time of arrest as well, saying this guy is just involved way too deep to take him on, to keep him under 15.
Yeah,
but I'll be conservative and keep it to below 50.
Well, she kept a I see my time is
go
up,
ahead.
But to finish my sentence,
question.
She would not have gone or did not say or indicate that she was going to do what she was going to do but for the statement of Mr. Melendez. And we can't allow sentences to happen when the judge clearly states she's relying on Mr. Melendez and there is no basis for finding that he is reliable. And for those reasons, we'd ask that you reverse the judgment of the district court.
Thank you. We will hear from Mr. Ness.
May it please the court, there are three reasons that the judgment and sentence of the district court should be affirmed. First, the district court committed no error, plain or otherwise, in applying the preponderance standard at sentencing. This court has repeatedly held that the due process clause does not require proof beyond a reasonable doubt at sentencing, and there is no basis for revisiting those holdings here.
Do you think the district court needed to give us a somewhat better roadmap as to how she actually got to the 15 to 50? I mean, which parts of Mr. Melendez's testimony was she crediting? Which parts was she not crediting?
Your Honor, actually, I believe that the district court gave a pretty clear, certainly sufficient for purposes of this appeal, roadmap for how the court arrived at that estimate. The court had before it a number of sentencing memoranda, including the government's memoranda, that set forth the calculations based on the estimates provided by Mr. Melendez. The court then took a look at the 9.5 kilograms that was found in Mr. Medina's garage, the cash, the jewelry, and then took a look at the statements of Mr. Medina, assessed those statements, found that those statements were reliable because they were so against
Mr. Melendez, you mean, I think.
Yes, did I misspeak? I'm sorry, Your Honor. Took a look at Mr. Melendez's statements and assessed them first for their reliability. The court found that they were reliable because they were so against Mr. Melendez's self-interest.
Can we talk about that for just a moment? One of the statements was a safety valve proffer, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
By Melendez.
Yes.
And what were the contexts of the other statements?
There was a post-arrest statement. It's my understanding that the record is not entirely clear in terms of the submissions that were given to the district court, but on the day of his arrest, Mr. Melendez gave, broadly speaking, a post-arrest statement. I think it happened at one location, and then they moved to another location. And then that was the day of his arrest.
Okay. And then was there an intervening one between the safety valve proffer?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Okay. Let me just ask. I guess I have trouble understanding how a safety valve proffer is against interest.
At that point, it's my understanding that the information that Mr. Melendez is giving, because it's not actually proffer protected, he's seeking the benefit of the safety valve, so he obviously under Section 3553F has to give all of the information he has pertaining to the offense.
Right.
That's not protected at that point. So that information can be...
It's not protected, but he is doing this for his own good at that point, right? In
yes,
order
sir.
To earn, or at least earn eligibility for the safety valve reductions.
That's correct. It does benefit him in that regard. But mm-hmm. as well, it also causes him to provide information. I think I could look at it this way, in the sense that he's making a calculated gamble that if I go in, give this safety valve interview to the government, I'm assessing the evidence. I think there's a good chance they're going to be able to prove by a preponderance that the drug quantity was X. So I'm going to go in, own up to that, and hope to get a reduction because I provided all the information that I have.
That I think they already have. That doesn't sound like a real safety valve proffer to me. It sounds a little too calculating, but...
And it may mm-hmm. certainly tug that way, Your Honor, but then we look back in time to the day of Mr. Melendez's arrest when he doesn't know anything about what's going on. He's in custody. He waives his Miranda rights voluntarily, and he proceeds to give a ton of information completely against his self-interest that sinks him. And he admits he engaged in a narcotics conspiracy with Lázaro Medina. He talks about a huge amount of weight, all of that is clearly against his self-interest at that point. So whether the safety valve proffer, you know, may tug two different ways, I think is certainly, I see Your Honor's point, but then we go back to the post-arrest statement, which not only is very much against Mr. Melendez's self-interest, but then corroborates the information that he gave at a safety valve proffer, and that's...
I'm thinking about this. I'm wondering whether we haven't got at least some kind of relationship to Bruton, if I can come out of right field here at you, in the sense that when we look at what parts of a co-defendant's confession may come in at trial, we tend to parse those pretty finely between the things that implicate the speaker, the declarant, the confessor, and the parts that implicate other people that may well be deceptive or in the declarant's own interest to try to divert attention from his own family or friends or the folks. The argument here, of course, is from cartel members who may retaliate against the speaker's family. And I'm wondering whether we shouldn't expect that kind of parsing in these sorts of statements as well.
Well, Judge Hamilton, I guess I would look at that from this standpoint, which is that in Bruton, obviously, unless I'm getting my law incorrect here, we were looking at a confrontation clause issue. Mm-hmm. Here at sentencing, that standard doesn't apply. So obviously there's no constitutional right, I don't think there is, to confront the witnesses against oneself.
No, but there is a standard of reliability. And we're in a kind of fuzzy never-never land here. You have a right to be sentenced on the basis of reliable and accurate information, but without all the procedural protections of trial.
Absolutely. Absolutely, that's right. And that was aired before the district court here in this sentencing. The district judge had all of the arguments that Your Honors have heard here today from Ms. Gambino about why Mr. Melendez's statements should not have been relied upon by the court. That the argument was made that he had a reason to divert attention away from cartel members to Mr. Medina. That argument was made. It's reflected in the transcript. The arguments were made that he was looking to benefit himself through the safety valve. Judge Buckle had all that before her. She assessed it. She made a decision that, okay, fine. And she even said at one point in the transcript that it troubled her that Mr. Melendez was not before the court for cross-examination. So the court was not unaware of the reliability issues that Your Honor is speaking of. But then she looked at the facts. She looked at Mr. Medina's statements that he had only engaged in narcotics trafficking since 2009. That was completely refuted by the evidence. She looked at the fact that he had 9.5 kilograms in his garage, $124,000, 50-some thousand dollars in jewelry. And this is a defendant who has never yet owned up to his involvement, to the magnitude in this crime, to the magnitude that he was involved in. If you look carefully at his statements throughout his interview, he did a safety valve interview. You look at all of his statements; they're all over the map. And he was found twice to have obstructed justice, or twice to have lied under oath in this case. So, faced with those competing facts, a co-conspirator who dumped all over himself, and a defendant who had nothing to offer other than lies upon lies, and concrete facts regarding what was found at Mr. Medina's house on the day of his arrest, I think the court made a very reasonable estimate and a conservative estimate.
In the absence of the government making an argument that the court should convert the cash located at the house into drugs for purposes of calculating the drug offense level, what in the district judge's reasoning in support of the sentence can we look at her mentioning of the $124,000 other than just as to add credibility or corroboration to the to Mr. Melendez's statement? Is there something else there that we could read into it?
Well, Judge Darrow, I think that there is. If you look at, going back, for example, to the change of plea transcript when Mr. Medina entered his blind plea of guilty, there, at one point, obviously the government gave a summary of the factual basis under Rule 11 for the guilty plea. We're not relying too heavily on that, I should say, by the way, because there is some lack of clarity in the transcript. But the government did say very clearly that Mr. Medina was involved from 2001 to 2009 in a conspiracy with Mr. Melendez. The government said that that Mr. Medina distributed kilogram quantities of cocaine to Mr. Melendez. And the government said that the cost of that, the price of that cocaine was $24,000, $28,000. Mr. Medina admitted to all of that when he pleaded guilty. The judge said, did you hear the statement of the assistant U.S. attorney? Yes. Is it correct? Yes. So that's corroboration as well. And then we have all the facts. I think the 9.5 kilograms fact really simply goes to show that Mr. Medina was not a small-time dealer involved in a small-time enterprise with Mr. Melendez. That's really the basis for that, Your Honor. In short, Your Honor, the defendant's arguments fail to show that the district court clearly erred in holding Mr. Medina responsible for the conservative estimated range of 15 to 50 kilograms. For these reasons and for the reasons in the government's brief, we ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Okay, thank you. And you may have a minute, Ms. Gambino.
Briefly, I'd like to respond to the safety valve proffer being against interest. I think it's clear from this defendant, and we have to, and judges do, take into account reality in this particular situation. Mr. Melendez started cooperating with the government from the very beginning, and he...
So do you attribute that to the post-arrest statement as well, or just
yes,
the safety
Well, there were
valve?
Two post-arrest statements, because he, in effect, provided three different pieces of information, three different quantity estimates of his dealings with Mr. Medina. So he's not making a statement against interest. He has determined from the very moment of his arrest that he is going to make statements that are going to help himself. And it's worth noting that the quantities that he provided in his post-arrest statement were higher than the ones that he provided in his safety valve statement, showing that he's aware of what he's doing, and when it counts for him, he's going to tailor the amounts to suit himself.
Well, those sorts of estimates are notoriously flexible. And
exactly.
Difficult, and that's why you treat them conservatively, as Judge Bucklow indicated she did. What about the plea colloquy?
The plea colloquy, Your Honor, it's also important to keep into the context of the case in this matter. Mr. Medina is not an English speaker. He is not highly educated. He did not get beyond elementary school level, and he did, with different counsel from his original counsel, try to withdraw that plea. Claiming that he did not understand what he was pleading guilty to. And, of course, the court rejected his attempt to do that. So it's not really clear that when he said yes, as a defendant must do if he's going to enter a plea of guilty, that he fully understood what he was admitting to.
Well, a defendant can disagree with portions and still admit essential elements, right?
That's absolutely true, Your Honor. I'm saying, though, that in this case, at least it's clear from what happened afterwards that Mr. Medina either was not comfortable with or had not been fully briefed about what he was supposed to do and what he was actually doing when he made his admissions. So it's not the case, as you might have, where all you have is the plea record in front of you.
Going back to the safety valve interview, I understand the argument that perhaps in that setting it's self-serving because the speaker is attempting to avail themselves of safety valve relief. But isn't it also a condition of safety valve relief that you provide a truthful accounting, and so therefore it might actually, the opposite might be true, that it's a more inherently credible statement?
Well, no, not necessarily. Because, and particularly in this case, where you see that the amounts that he provided in his post-arrest statement were greater than those that he provided in his safety valve statement. And so, you know, if he thinks he's got to do something that's more truthful, you'd think the numbers would go higher rather than lower. I think that defendants are very well aware when they do a safety valve statement, what's at issue for them and what they have to do both to help themselves and to please the government. Because, after all, whatever their concept of truth is, it doesn't matter. What matters is what the government believes the truth is, because they're the ultimate arbiters in terms of the fifth provision, which is if they don't believe you, you don't get the safety valve. So it's really not as clear-cut as we'd like it to be in terms of who's thinking about being more truthful or not truthful. I think it's...
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Gambino.
Thank you.
The case will be taken under advisement.